This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. Last week, two vaccines developed in record-smashing time were rolled out nationwide to address the COVID-19 pandemic, just as infections, hospitalizations, and deaths from the disease also hit new records worldwide. At the same time, there's been a different kind of viral spread of questionable information about the disease, its treatment, and the new vaccines. This week on The Compass, we talk once again with Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Tom Locke, who addresses a couple of the videos that have gone viral online, and then we talk about the local rollout of the vaccine. So now, let's go inside The Compass. Why don't we start out with a couple of things that have kind of gone viral, especially in the, you know, like people who are given to following conspiracy theories. And one of them, and apparently this has really gone viral across the country, there's a YouTube of Dr. Pierre Corey of Wisconsin, who spoke before a Senate hearing last week, and was really vehemently touting ivermectin, which I gather is an anti-parasitic drug for pets. So, I mean, I kind of have this question, first of all, you know, like what people are even doing feeding anti-parasite drugs to patients. I mean, maybe you could talk a little bit about protocols and I mean, what powers doctors have to test drugs on patients, and then talk a little bit about ivermectin and whatever is known about its effect on coronavirus.
Well, I think it helps to understand this in the context of how COVID-19 just burst on the scene. And initially, it was a runaway infection. People were dying. They were hitting the emergency rooms and the ICUs, and doctors had no established treatments. So it's a natural thing to try all kinds of different things and see if they have an effect. The danger in that is you can often convince yourself that something works when it really doesn't. In other words, you give something to someone, they get better, and you think it's the drugs did that instead of the fact that they just naturally got better. And in a disease like COVID-19, where fortunately the survival rate is incredibly high, it's over 99% in most populations, a lot of things that you give people may actually have no effect at all. And so science has a way of resolving those questions. We do randomized controlled studies, and we see if the effect is really from the drug or if it's just kind of random or based on the ways we've selected patients non-randomly. And that's essentially what's going on with this ivermectin story. Ivermectin is a very useful anti-parasite drug that in laboratory conditions, in test tube conditions, very high doses of ivermectin inhibit the SARS-CoV virus. And the problem is those levels are not achievable in the human body. So you need very high levels. So the normal therapeutic levels of ivermectin do not have that same effect. And there have been some kind of casually done studies where they've given it to some groups and not other groups. And it looks like the groups that have gotten the ivermectin have done better. But those are not randomized studies. So ivermectin is something that it's worth studying, but so far there have been no good randomized double-blind studies, which is the gold standard in science. There's just been these kind of anecdotal studies where people give it to some people who are non-randomly selected and then give it to others and compare those two groups. And when you do those kind of studies, you can easily be fooled. It can seem like something is helping when it isn't. And then someone who even worse, someone with medical credentials who goes before Congress or gets on the media and touts something as a miracle drug, cure for everything, they almost certainly are wrong and are, in fact, are abusing their position by advocating something without scientific evidence to back it up.
There's a doctor, Vernon Coleman, who's a British physician. There's a video of him that's also like spreading around, sitting in an easy chair with a book open in front of him, which I guess he purports is the CDC published evidence about the vaccines. And he says that some 2.79% of the people who've taken the vaccine have had bad symptoms. They've been like, out of work the day afterwards and had to be under like a doctor's care, and sort of insinuates that that's just like, the initial effects, and who knows what the medium and long-term effects are. So, he's really doing his best to sort of undermine security in the vaccine. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and what the actual evidence is of side effects from the vaccines.
Well, there's been an organized international group of people who have opposed vaccinations for a very long time. And we've expected them to actively oppose the COVID-19 vaccine. They are just fundamentally against the concept of vaccination and think that natural infection is preferable to preventing infection with vaccines. We very much disagree. Any choice you make involves measuring the risks of what you do against the benefits you get from it. And in the case of COVID-19 vaccine, it's already apparent that the benefit far outweighs the risk. The risks are remarkably low with the vaccine based on the evidence we have to date, and we'll be accumulating more evidence with each passing day. But the best evidence we have is just in the original clinical trials. Around 10% of people did have mild flu-like symptoms for the first 24 hours after the vaccine. And after the second vaccine, it was even more pronounced. It was up to 20% of people would get low-grade fever and muscle aches. And that's actually what we expect, because the vaccine is turning on your immune system and teaching it how to defend you against the spike protein that covers the outside of the coronavirus. So that's kind of the price we pay for that increased immunologic memory. We know that COVID-19 is a very serious disease. Fortunately, most people recover uneventfully, but about a third of the people who get it have prolonged recovery, more than a week or two, and about 10% have very long recovery periods, and we don't even know if they will fully recover. It's likely that some people will have permanent lung and heart damage, and so you're kind of comparing that to the rather trivial effects of the vaccine. But I would remind people that vaccination is entirely voluntary. So people that don't want to be vaccinated shouldn't be vaccinated for this disease. But for so-called experts who want to grab the spotlight by running this down are just ignoring the horrible toll in terms of death and disability and economic dislocation that this pandemic is causing. And they are often the people that say the way out is just to let the virus run unimpeded through society and achieve herd immunity. But that's also something we vigorously disagree with. It would take years for that process to complete itself. Millions and millions of people would die. And we don't even have any solid evidence that natural immunity to COVID-19 lasts more than about 3 months. So vaccine is the way out of the pandemic. I don't think there's many responsible scientists who would argue with that premise.
We don't really know either how long the vaccine lasts, though, right? I mean, how long the immunity
We have some clues. It was designed to last at least a year, and we won't know for sure until a year has passed. But you can tell based on the degree that it stimulates the immune system and how many antibodies are produced and how much it stimulates these things called T cells, which are kind of the repository of immunologic memory. It's actually looking pretty good that the vaccine will last at least a year, maybe longer.
When we talk about like the length of time the vaccine will work, you know, of course, I immediately think of the flu and the fact that we seem to need to get a new flu shot each year. So is this mutating as quickly as the flu does?
It's hard to compare the two. They're very different viruses. All viruses mutate. Viruses are kind of renegade genetic material, RNA, DNA. They compel our cells to make copies of them, and that copying process is inaccurate. So they're constantly making mistakes, and we actually use those subtle mutations as a way of tracking different strains. And occasionally the virus will mutate in a way that makes it more dangerous, that makes it more contagious, or makes it so it causes more severe disease. It can go the other way too. Where the virus mutates in a way that it becomes weaker and less dangerous. But the ones we're especially concerned about are when the mutations make it easier for the virus to spread, because those mutations tend to accumulate in the population by virtue of that virus is out competing the other viruses and becomes the predominant strain. We have good evidence that happened at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, that the original strain out of Wuhan, China, was not the strain that spread through most of Europe and the United States. That was a mutant strain that was more contagious. And it is possible that what's being seen in Britain and South America is a new, more contagious strain. The jury's not in on it. They don't have enough evidence yet to make any definite determinations, but it's a possibility. One bit of favorable news is that the mutations that they're seeing in this British strain are unlikely to affect the effectiveness of the vaccine. The vaccine is targeted against the entire spike protein of the virus, and the spike protein is the virus's Achilles heel, that it has to attach to the cells with that, and it can't gain entry to our cells without its spike protein. And so if our immune system attacks that, we have an effective defense. And the spike protein is complex. It has hundreds of different sites on it for antibodies to attach to. So mutations in a small number of sites on the spike protein are unlikely to allow the virus to evade the vaccine. But over a course of years and years, it's a definite possibility that the virus will evolve in a way that makes our current vaccine ineffective in future years. And there, this new generation of vaccines, these messenger RNA vaccines, offer a real benefit in that you can change the messenger RNA. So if the spike protein changes, you change the payload of the vaccine to produce antibodies against the new spike protein that's emerged.
Now, if you change the payload, would you have to go through another round of trials?
It's unlikely that they would require the manufacturer to go through all the clinical trial testing. All really they'd have to prove is that the new vaccine worked against the new strain. That would be the test.
Well, so while we're on the subject of mutations and different strains of the disease, I've been reading about the culling of all of the minks in Denmark, and the fact that especially on mink farms, there has been like real transmission both from humans to mink, and then also from minks to human. And I guess most concerning to the scientists who are looking at it is that some dozen or so cases, the strain that came back from minks seem to be resistant to protective antibodies. And so I wonder if you have any comments on those.
Well, that's a concern with a lot of different viruses. It has been all along for influenza. Influenza is pandemic influenza is basically bird flu that jumps into the human population and sometimes jumps to other animals, most notably swine. And so as it moves back and forth between birds and humans and swine, it can take on characteristics that make it more dangerous. And it looks like coronaviruses can do the same thing. The coronaviruses largely emerge from bat populations, but then move into other animals, you know, what are called intermediate or vector species. And this whole area of diseases moving back and forth between humans and animals is called zoonotics. And it applies to a lot of different diseases. It's what makes our current style of, you know, mega agriculture, you know, raising animals in farms with millions and millions of animals, be they chicken or mink or cattle, it makes it so dangerous from an infectious disease standpoint. Because if these diseases, they can get into these very large populations, they can mutate, and then they can go back into humans. And it could, at least theoretically, create a new and more dangerous strain of the coronavirus. That's what they're trying to prevent. And that actually that's happened many times with influenza. It's gotten into bird populations, poultry farms, and they've had to call the entire farm, millions and millions of birds, to prevent that influenza strain from spreading to other populations. So this is not new for coronavirus, but it's yet another concern we have with this pandemic strain, that it could become even more lethal than it is now.
Okay, well, let's move back to the local now. And we've received now, I understand, our second shipment of vaccines, and I understand that vaccinations are well underway. How far along are we with the first course? I mean, what percentage of the 1A first category people have already received their vaccines at this point? And what's the sort of timeline for everybody in that category being vaccinated before we move on to 1B?
The latest information I have is about 720 people have started their vaccination series out of that initial 975 doses. And the hospital, Jefferson Healthcare, has received a second shipment. We're trying to get clarification as to whether this second shipment is for us to complete the first round of vaccinations, or if it, you know, allows us to enroll even more people. The system of tracking, you know, of guaranteeing how many shipments you're getting, that it's still unstable, but we expect it to stabilize. So the hospital's doing an extraordinary job moving through the 1A list, which is the current priority category that's being vaccinated: healthcare workers, first responders, and Jefferson Healthcare is doing most of the staff of long-term care facilities, and then there's some contract pharmacies that are going to do the residents of the long-term care facilities. So we hope to finish that list by the end of the month, sometime next week. And then,
how many people are in that list?
I believe there was over 1,000 people on the list, but you know, not everyone wants to be vaccinated. Not everyone who's eligible wants to be vaccinated, and that's their choice. We think some people who are reluctant to have the vaccine now, you know, when it's just been released, will feel more comfortable, you know, after millions and millions of people have had it nationwide. So that's fine. You know, it will come back. You don't, if you're on the 1A list, you don't lose your chance to get the vaccine just because you wait. It just means that we vaccinate everyone in that priority. Now we make sure that our partners in other counties have been able to do likewise. And then as a state, we'll move on into the 1B list. And we're having a meeting today to really clarify who's going to be on the 1B list, because the CDC's advisory committee made some major changes in that category this Sunday when they met. But the real decision is up to the state of Washington. The final priorities are set state by state. So what the group called the ACIP decided this weekend is that the two groups on the 1B list are number one, what they called frontline essential workers. These are people like, you know, who work in grocery stores and bus drivers, transit systems, prison guards, teachers, law enforcement officials, people who have this very direct, unavoidable contact with the public on a daily basis. And then the second group is anyone over age 75. And so that constitutes nationwide, that's about 49 million people. And we will have enough vaccine in January to vaccinate about 30 million people is what the projections are. But, you know, not everyone on the 1B list is going to want to be vaccinated.
Right.
So in Washington state has the authority to kind of change around the priorities. The CDC group also established the next. So the third priority group is what they call a second tier essential workers, which is going to be a lot of government workers and essential industries, things where they're essential to the functioning of society, but their jobs do not put them at high risk of COVID exposure. And then adults over 65, or at that point, it'll be between 65 and 75. And then that third group is also people with high risk medical conditions of all ages, people with chronic kidney disease or type 2 diabetes or, you know, number of other chronic medical conditions. So the bottom line is that they're projecting there will be enough vaccine between the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine to immunize 100 million people by the end of February. That's what we're being told. But there are more than 100 million people nationwide on those three priorities, 1A, 1B, and 1C.
So I know that there were a couple of cases really early on when Britain introduced the vaccine, a couple of cases of anaphylaxis. And I understand that there have been more in this first rollout.
Actually, allergic reactions and anaphylaxis, which is the most severe of the reactions, it's kind of right. An allergic shock type right. state, is, you know, it's a problem with all, or a potential problem with all vaccines and a number of injectable medications. So it's something we're always looking for in healthcare, and we're very good at treating it. And so, yes, someone who has a allergic reaction to a, especially a serious allergic reaction, so a generalized or anaphylactoid reaction, it's not a contraindication. It's not a reason to avoid the vaccine, but it puts you in a different monitoring group. So it's currently everybody who gets this vaccine gets monitored for 15 minutes after they get the vaccine. If you have this history of serious allergic reaction, then we monitor you for 30 minutes after the vaccination, and we, in the sites where we're giving this vaccine, we are prepared to treat anaphylaxis, and that's the way it's going to be throughout the rollout. We don't know yet whether the Moderna vaccine, which is just starting to be distributed, has the same problem, but we will certainly find out as millions and millions of people start to get vaccinated. As we get into this 20 million range of people being vaccinated, we will have a much better idea of the safety profile of this vaccine than we did based on the 22,000 people who got it in the clinical trials. So if anyone who's been vaccinated so far is listening there, they will attest to the fact that everybody gets this phone app called V-Safe, and any kind of reactions you get, you report them to the CDC via the phone app. And if you have a serious reaction, like a generalized allergic reaction, we report that. The people who gave you the vaccine report it to this national registry.
Right. Well, listen, we've basically run out of time, but I wonder if there's anything further you would like to put out there.
Well, just having a vaccine available is a very hopeful thing. And we're finding so far locally, the side effects are very mild. We do predict that the second dose will produce more of a reaction. So we're cautioning people, they may have to take a day off work the day after they get vaccinated the second time, or maybe 20 to 40% of people will. We'll only know that when we see it. And then the final remark I'd make is this being the holiday season, this is a dangerous time in terms of COVID transmission. Right now, Jefferson County has one of the lowest rates of infection in the state, but that shouldn't lull us into a sense of security. Is it travel right now, having non-household members in your house, having out of area or out of state visitors is dramatically increases your risk of getting infected. And we really want people to try to not get infected while they're waiting patiently in line for their time to get the vaccine to come due. So this Christmas season is going to be crucial. If we can prevent a major surge of this infection in the Christmas season, I think we'll do well in the next 3 months and just being able to keep a lid on things. If we have a major surge on top of our current levels, we would really be in danger of overwhelming our hospitals. So we are asking people to make very serious sacrifices and tough choices and constrain their holiday plans to just the absolute minimum that you can get away with.
With Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Tom Locke, this is Steve Evans for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Saturdays at noon and repeats on Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.